Well, of marriage generally is to train us how to transform ourselves from those who naturally want to take to those who are willing to give of ourselves to another. And that the essence of love is, number one, both the recognition of godly qualities in another person, and by godly I mean those qualities that we would associate with spiritual beauty, and that can include a lot of things. That includes kindness, compassion, humor, intelligence, wit, all the different things that we love a person for. And after identifying those qualities, the willingness to want to become close to that person by sharing of yourself to another. That is why we find that the concept of marriage is referred to in the Torah as entering the congregation of God. For example, it's really stated in the negative. Those who are not allowed to marry, the phrase that is used is, they may not enter the congregation of God. Which means, conversely, marriage is a relationship that is considered to be entering the Kahal Hashem, the congregation of God. The reason that so is because God's ultimate attribute, it is said, is that of a giver and not a taker, because there's nothing in reality that we can give to God. In fact, everything we give to God is just a mechanism by which God can bestow His goodness and kindness upon us. If you're familiar with the writings of the Ari and of Moshe Chaim Luzzatto, he basically explains that God created a universe because God wanted to bestow goodness on His creations. So why didn't God just create a world where all we have is goodness? Because if he would have given us a goodness that we have not earned, that really wouldn't be a full goodness, because we would always feel guilty at getting a handout. In the language of the Ari, any goodness that we would get in the world that would be totally unearned would be nahama de kisufa, which is Aramaic for the bread of embarrassment or shame. So consequently, it is part of God's goodness that He creates a world in which we have to struggle to become deserving of His goodness. Yeah.
Question real quick. Wasn't the world, when it was originally created with Adam before he took the fruit, wasn't this a perfect world? Wasn't Adam a perfect creation? If he would have just lasted that first Sabbath, then the world would have been...
Yeah, that's correct. But even then, you see, God created a world in which there was at least one obstacle that man had to reach. Meaning, God didn't want to make it too hard of a test, but God did require that test, because that would make the reward earned and not unearned. That's right. So consequently, the concept is, God is a giver and not a taker. Consequently, if I'm a human being that's made in the image of God, I become a godly person only to the extent I develop within myself the capacity of giving rather than receiving. And therefore, the concept of marriage is to enable me, and again, I want to emphasize that even those of us who aren't married yet, but the point is, this is still an aspiration in our own lives. In other words, to develop that side of ourselves that is the giver and not the taker. And that creates the idea of holiness, of godliness in life. That the more a person gives, the more they are godly. Because God is a giver and not a taker. In fact, this explains what we say at a bris. You know, many of you may have been here on Friday. Oh, you were away. But Friday, one of the men in the kollel had a and his wife had a baby boy. So we had a bris here. And you probably don't remember your own bris, but if you've been at a bris since, you know that we announce this way. We announce, Kishem Shenichnas Lebris, as the child has entered the bris, the covenant, Kein Yikone, so shall he enter Torah, the learning of Torah, Chupa, getting married, Masim Tovim, good deeds. Now there's a little bit of a question here if you think about it, because that sequence of three events is not chronological. Torah, you know, as soon as a child learns to talk, they study Torah. But Masim Tovim, good deeds, normally refers to when you're bar mitzvah. Getting married occurs after bar mitzvah. Even according to Pirkei Avos, which has a pretty young age for men to get married, it gives 18 to get married. Most of us get married later than that. So it should have said, Torah, Masim Tovim, then Chuppah. Why does it say Torah, Chuppah, Masim Tovim? And the suggestion might be that the meaning of Maasim Tovim does not refer to technical mitzvahs. Technical mitzvahs are earlier than Chuppah. But it refers to the following idea. There are many things in Judaism, really, that the halacha doesn't tell you one way or the other. Let's say that you go to a rabbi and you ask a rabbi, I'm undecided whether I should buy Cheerios or cornflakes for breakfast. What would the Torah say I have to do? Well, the rabbi's answer is likely to be, assuming he's patient enough not to, you know, dismiss you out of hand, his answer is likely to be, well, as long as both are kosher, you can choose what you want to do. In other words, there are many activities in life. You know, some activities are things you got to do. Some activities are things you're not allowed to do. And there's a lot of activities in which, you know, you have the choice to do or not to do. In other words, these are optional activities. These are not activities that are either mitzvos, nor are they activities that are averos. Yeah, which one? Yeah, yes, yeah, no, of course, a person should eat. You're certainly correct. A person should eat for the sake of serving God, etc. But whether it's one cereal or another cereal, there is no halacha that mandates that it be one thing or the other. Now, obviously, if you can serve God better with Cheerios, you should buy Cheerios. But in many cases, it's not going to make a big difference. Now, here's the thing. Imagine the day after you get married. Right, you're doing your first shopping. Right, the day after the wedding, you know, you get home, there's no food in the house. Right, so you go shopping for your wife. And you're about to kind of go on automatic pilot and buy the Cheerios that you always buy. But all of a sudden, you know, a sickening realization dawns upon you. You know, my wife likes cornflakes. At that moment, you are at one of the great crossroads of your life. What are you going to buy at that moment? Oh, okay, there's a few things. You have three choices at that point. You can be selfish and inconsiderate even a day after your marriage and buy the Cheerios. You can be generous and a martyr and buy the cornflakes. Or you could kind of be a reasonably prudent person and buy two boxes or whatever it might be. Now here's the thing. If you decide to take into account the other person's needs, either by only getting the cornflakes or by getting both, you have converted a mundane act of no importance whatsoever. It has become an act of holiness, an act of goodness, an act of compassion, an act of godliness, an act of chesed. Same thing with all the decisions in life. Where you live, what furniture you have, whether you have wallpaper or paint, might normally be a matter which has no particular spiritual dimensions. Now, of course, where you live obviously could, in the sense, in other words, should I move to Yerushalayim or Timbuktu? That obviously is a decision which has spiritual import. But, you know, should I live in this house or next door? But when you take into account the needs of another person, your action becomes godly. And therefore, the idea of masim tovim in that passage doesn't refer to commandments. Commandments is when you're bar mitzvah. But it refers to when do you reach a situation where every single mundane act potentially is an act of godliness and chesed, that is bederech klal, in the normal course of events, not exclusively, but in the normal course of events, marriage creates that great opportunity. Meaning to say, marriage was created to give us meaning men, and from the women's perspective, women, the opportunity to become godly by learning to become selfless givers rather than egotistical takers. Yeah.
Isn't it possible that in giving you're expecting something in return, so that it's not truly an altruistic?
Well, obviously that's so, and that's why I always talk about selfless giving, and that really brings me to my next point. That's a good point, and that is, alright, so that's really point number one, is that the goal of a relationship is to teach me, and teach the other person as well, teach the people in the relationship how to give. Not use each other like the mashal I gave yesterday about the fish, where you love the fish and you chew it up and eat it up and then spit out the bones. And we often define that as love, and that's really nothing more than self-love. And unfortunately, the concept of love that is often used in the world is using people for our own self-gratification. But, you know, Michael's point is that altruism, and this is point number two, altruism, or at least behaviors that seem altruistic, can also be a form of self gratification. And that is, part of learning to give to another actually means opening oneself up to be willing to take from the other. And that's a very important point. Because imagine you have a relationship where a person prides himself or herself on always giving up, always giving into the other person, always, you know, being the one who gives and never takes. And you walk away with the illusion that you're so wonderful and so good, but the one thing you haven't given the other person is a sense of self-esteem, a sense of self-respect, a sense of being needed. The greatest gift one can give another person is a sense that they are needed for us. And consequently, true selfless giving involves having the courage to expose one's vulnerability to be able to take. And this is something in particular, again, without overgeneralizing with male and female, but this is something that men in particular sometimes have difficulties doing. The famous observation that one of the fundamental differences between men and women is their willingness to ask directions when they get lost. It's famous. It's a well-known... Actually, it is probably a true observation as well. It's not just a cliche. And I know myself, in my own experiences in traveling, I have occasion to get lost very often at various places. And men do not like to ask directions till we're at least like 2 hours, out of the way. When we're really desperate, we're down to the last, we're out of gas and there's no gas station, maybe we'll break down. On the other hand, women seem to be almost obsessed with asking directions right away. We could be pulling out of our driveway, going to New York, 3 or 4 hours away. Are you sure you have the directions in Borough Park? Let's call up, let's ask someone. Now, why is there this difference? The difference fundamentally actually rests on a very deep spiritual distinction. And that is to say, a man's fundamental identity is bound up with autonomy and control. A human being, a male human being, normally defines his essence as a self-sufficient entity who is capable of taking charge of a situation. Any concession to that vulnerability, any sense that one needs another human being to get something accomplished, is by definition a threat to the identity of the person. Women, on the other hand, essentially define themselves as part of community. And in fact, there's even a mystical reason for this. And the mystical reason for this is that, I think it says in the Zohar, that the first moments of Adam's creation, Adam came into the world alone. Again, this is going, there are two opinions in Chazal. This is not going with the opinion that they came in as a male, a female, and was split. There is an opinion in Chazal that says, first there was Adam, and then Eve was created from Adam. So it turns out that the fundamental first moments of Adam's life, it's kind of like an imprinting, you kind of get defined by the initial situation in which you find yourself. Adam's first moments were aloneness. It was not good for man to be alone, so God created Eve. But the essential idea of aloneness is imprinted on the male personality. Eve never had a world without Adam in it. Eve came into a world of relationship, of interaction, of communication. And hence, because of that fundamental idea, communication, interaction, and shared enterprise does not undermine a woman's sense of identity as it does a man. And in fact, it's very, very interesting. I think you probably have had a number of classes on this, but one should be aware of the fact of the work of Carol Gilligan, a very, very esteemed social psychologist in Harvard, who wrote in the late 70s and throughout the 1980s, I bet she's probably still writing, her famous work was A Different Voice, and she demonstrated that from a very early age, boys and girls have fundamentally different perceptions of morality. In other words, she was basically arguing that unlike the feminist critique, that men and women are essentially the same, but there are environmental influences which stereotype them, and consequently we need to obliterate the stereotypes, which is a position Judaism never accepted. But Carol Gilligan, a woman, non-Jew, demonstrated that there are innate fundamental differences in the way they view the world. This doesn't go to equality. Obviously men and women are equal, that's not the issue, but they are different. Men are from Mars, women are from Venus, or the Jewish version, men are from Borough Park, women are from Flatbush. It's a version that they. Yeah.
You had mentioned that Matzim Tovim comes after Chuppah.
Yes,
is it that you can have Matzim Tovim even beforehand in a family situation if you consider it of other people?
Absolutely. We have to try to endeavor to make Matzim Tovim all the time. But it happens to be, just as a practical matter, that the daily and constant Matzim Tovim, you have many more occasions in a marriage. That Chas HaShalom does not mean that until we get married we don't strive for Masim Tovim. Certainly, even living in a dormitory, you have many, many such occasions. And certainly with our interactions with parents and the like. But marriage creates that constant 24-hour-a-day situation. So here's the thing. So Carol Gilligan's book, she administered a series of tests to boys and girls who were between 6 and 8, And the test involved, and she analyzed the results, she called the male response Jake Slatter, and the female response Charlotte's Web. Those of you who remember your childhood know that Charlotte's Web is a well-beloved the children's book. But she called it Charlotte's Web. And here was the story. Let's assume you had a child who was dying of an illness, and the only medicine that could save your child is in a drugstore in town. And the drugstore's already closed for the day. And they're not going to open until 8 o'clock the next morning, and by then, God forbid, the child might die. What do you do? Right? Asking little kids. So the boys inevitably said, you take a rock, you smash the window, and you take the medicine. Of course! You got to save life. Now, that is a totally correct response. Obviously, saving a life takes precedence. The girls said it too. But the girls added a few details. Okay, but we have to be sure to leave a note. We have to be sure to try to call the police ahead of time so they'll know that we're doing this, and that way the owner can be compensated. In other words, what she called the latter was, look at this, men tended to identify a crucial variable, and the question is either on or off, up or down. Is life more important or is money more important? Life is more important. You save life. Women saw the reality in a little girls saw the reality in a much more complex way. There's a web here. Good, yes, you have to save a life. But you also have to be sure that the owner of the drugstore, his interests are taken care of as well. And you have to be sure the glass gets cleaned up after you break there, right? The concept of seeing the interlocking relationships. And this goes back to the fact that women do indeed have a sense of relationship. We know that women tend to keep their friendships for a much more longer period of time. Very often once a man gets married, has children, etc., he may often not actively pursue the development of relationships, the buddies that he hung around with in college or whatever it is. Again, these are stereotypes, I know, but they are generalizations that do hold true in many, many cases. Women do. So all of this goes back to the fact, by the way, I want to even say, just to give you a little speculation, people sometimes ask, why can't women be counted for a minyan? Why is the concept of minyan only for men? And there's a technical reason. The technical reason is that the whole source of minyan is designed to be an atonement for the evil spies, right? The spies were 10 out of the 12 spies came back with a negative report, and they desecrated God's name. So 10 men come together, and they sanctify God's name. And since women were not part of the bad spies who created the problem, so they don't need to be part of the group that sanctifies God's name. But one might suggest a sociological reason, and this is just, I don't claim this is necessarily true, but it's a speculation that is consistent with the halacha, that what a minyan basically is, what does a minyan tell a man? A minyan tells a man, there's a lot of stuff in life you can't do alone, you got to do with somebody else. You can't just think that you're so self-sufficient that you could read the Torah and say the Kedusha and repeat the Shemona Esrei. You need other people. Leave the autonomy and connect yourself with others. It is a form of forced compulsory association to teach the male that the self-sufficiency that is so prominent a part of our identity is a myth and is not entirely true. A woman does not have the institution of minyan because the concept of compulsory association is unnecessary, because association, collectivity, and community is part of a natural consciousness that already exists. And you find in many areas of halacha that where there is already a natural consciousness of a given idea, there is no need to concretize it as a halachic requirement. You often find the idea that halachic requirements come to overcome the deficiencies in our perceptions of reality. That when the reality is properly perceived, there may not have to be a law that regulates it. So the idea here is that part of learning to be a giver is the willingness to be humble and be vulnerable and express and communicate to the other that we need them to give to us, right? So that's the paradox, that sometimes the best way to give is actually to take, by letting the other person do something or be something or communicate something that you indicate that you need. That's the idea of giving. Yeah?
Speculation about women always having a need to be, like, instinctively communal.
Yes.
Well,
Okay, okay. Well, you're correct. I mean, again, one can identify many aspects of this. And in fact, even the concept of pregnancy is related to this, because a man's relationship to pregnancy is essentially very distant and removed. In other words, the life that a man contributes in making is not part of the man's body. The woman has the fundamental connection to the fetus, to the embryo, and then there's nursing. There's a constant notion of bonding and connectiveness that a male lacks. And in fact, to a large degree, we will see that some of the help, you know, a woman is described as being a helpmate to a man. Part of that help is to enable the man to transcend that autonomy and that egotism, to become part of, to unite and connect to others. Now, the central insight that giving sometimes involves taking, actually I once saw a reference, I think when I was in seventh grade, we read the autobiography of Benjamin Franklin. Maybe you read that in the course of your life. And very, you know, an interesting book. Ben Franklin was a very gifted, creative guy. And he writes that when he first came to Boston to make his fortune as a young fellow, he was thinking about what's the best way to get to make connections with people, right? How do you make friends and influence people, type of thing. So he was thinking he wanted to approach the wealthy people in town, but he didn't want to ask them for any big favors. He needed, because after all, they would feel resentful, and even if they gave in to him, they would feel you know, he was too much of an imposition. On the other hand, he said, he didn't want to ingratiate himself to them by doing them favors, because then they would feel beholden and resentful. So he hit upon this idea, that the best way to have people like you is to approach them and ask them to do you a favor that is very minor and insignificant, but you give the impression that it's something that you really need. And he made the point, because people feel very good when they can do something for you that's really no inconvenience for them, but that you appear to be phenomenally grateful for. In other words, he made the point that the best thing he could give to them would be to ask them to give to him, but not too much. Right? That was his. Now, of course, he was not doing it for altruistic or saintly reasons. He was doing it to get ahead in business. But this is an idea that that does work in other contexts as well. By the way, Benjamin Franklin, one could write, you know, PhDs are always written on obscure topics. In fact, I saw a list in a college magazine. A scholar of medieval history did a survey on what types of things medieval scholars are writing about today, because, you know, all the major historical issues, you know, have more or less been addressed. So it's really kind of all sorts of obscure things, like, you know, history of pus and medieval literature. You know, they're really this is a serious title, you know, and the like. So if one wanted to write an interesting PhD dissertation, one could actually write about the influence of Benjamin Franklin on the Musar movement. And this is not a joke. The Musar movement was a movement of Gedolim, of great rabbis in the 19th century, who, Rabbi Saul Solange was the leader of it, who wrote books dealing with character improvement and the like, you know, how to improve your midot and everything. And there are certain books which are very well regarded and very well studied, but it's been determined that a lot of the material was lifted almost verbatim from Poor Richard's Almanac and some of the stuff of Benjamin Franklin. I mean, I don't want to mention the Sefer, a very, very famous Mr. Sefer, which Rabbi Saul Solange loved and advocated that people learn, was actually taken from Benjamin Franklin. So Benjamin Franklin actually has a connection to the Musar movements for the Jews. Okay. But be it as it may, that's the idea of, so point number one is the idea of giving. Point number two is that the way we give self-esteem to someone is by being open to take and by forging a relationship, and that's very difficult because of the male's penchant for autonomy and control and domination. Point number three, if you remember the verse in Genesis when God created Eve, so it says, it is not good for man to be alone, or for Adam might be the bisexual creature, to be alone. I will make him a helpmate to be opposite him. These are two words. Ezer, helpmate, kenegdo, to be opposite him. Now the Talmud already asks that this is a contradiction. Ezer is someone who helps me. Kenegdo is someone who opposes me. So is it supposed to be Ezer? Or is it supposed to be kenegdo? So Rashi gives a common sense answer. Rashi says, well, it all depends. Sometimes you get one, sometimes you get the other. If a person has merits, he gets Ezer, someone who's a helpmate in life. If you don't get merit, you get kinegdo, somebody who's always against you, always opposite you, etc. But in the Sifrei Chassidus, we have the following insight. And that is, these two phrases, or these two words, are not contradictions. They are, in fact, complementary words. That sometimes the greatest help one person can be to another person is when there is a certain creative opposition. I don't mean denigration, but a sense in which each one brings to the table a unique perspective, a different perspective, an opposite perspective. Here's the issue. All of us, on some level, would like to find someone that is a clone of ourselves. Of course, you can't have a different sex clone, technically, but as close as possible. You know, there's a little wind-up toy that is made available for beleaguered junior executives, you know, who have just been criticized too many times. And the little wind-up toy is a little doll that says, "You're great, you never make mistakes, wonderful guy, the world doesn't understand you." And you wind up this toy and you put it on your desk and you have this little wind-up toy giving you that reassurance all day. And, you know, and indeed, sometimes we need that. And indeed, one of the things, I mean, there's no question that one of the things a supportive spouse does is what we call stroking. I mean, I'm all for stroking. That's a good thing. The world, you know, beats us down sometimes, both men and women, and part of coming home is that you have somebody that gives you encouragement. However, we also know that to have a clone of ourselves means we're never going to grow. If we come into marriage, we come into life with prejudices, with biases, with, you know, flaws in our own character, and we have somebody who does nothing more than mirror and duplicate those deficiencies in our character. Then first of all, why get married? Like, what's the use? In other words, if all you're going to do is duplicate exactly who you are, then how is there ever going to be transformation? How is there ever going to be growth? So consequently, Sifrei Chassidus make the beautiful idea that the true help in a marriage is the different perspective of reality that the other person can bring. Now, there's a balance here. We're not talking about someone, whether it's a man or a woman, who is judgmental, who is critical, who doesn't see, you know, the good points in your character, who doesn't encourage you. That, of course, is destructive. One, God forbid, should never enter into a relationship with someone who is so negative and critical and denigrating of the good things that you have that they're not recognized. But within, in fact, there's a term, in politics, there's a term called the loyal opposition. You know, an opposition, a minority, but they're fundamentally loyal to a government. Well, in marriage, you can have what is called the loving opposition. That indeed, there may be an opposition, right? That if I'm behaving, and this is very hard to take, but if I'm behaving in a selfish, immature, unreasonable way, then the greatest love that a spouse can do is to help me go beyond my limitations, and vice versa as well. I'm not suggesting, you know, it's only the man, you know, the woman is there to correct. It's a mutual thing, but the whole point is to help us become more than we were. Or maybe not more than we were, but to help us realize those aspects of ourselves that would be dormant and not fully realized. And that is the idea of Ezer Kenegdo. We see this idea even in teaching of Torah. The Gemara says in Bava Metzia that Rav Yochanan, the great Rav Yochanan, one of the great rabbis of the Gemara, had a student, Reish Lakish. In fact, this is a whole story in and of itself. You may recall that Reish Lakish started off life, I don't know if he started off life, but at some point in his life, he was a highway robber. He was a bandit. And he once attacked Rav Yochanan and was about to slaughter Rav Yochanan. But Rav Yochanan promised him that if he doesn't kill him and if he does tshuva and studies Torah, Rav Yochanan will arrange his sister to marry him. Of course, he didn't talk to his sister at the time, but I guess Rav Yochanan knew that his sister would agree to whatever Shidduch Rav Yochanan proposed. And Reish Lakish became a great, great Torah scholar. And he married Rav Yochanan's sister, and he was Rav Yochanan's brother-in-law, therefore. And if you remember the Gemara, very, very often when we have arguments in the Talmud, one of the arguments are between Rav Yochanan and Reish Lakish, you know, arguments over things. Now, the Gemara says that whenever Rav Yochanan would give a class, Reish Lakish would ask him 24 questions, 24 attacks, which Rav Yochanan had to answer. And at one point, Reish Lakish died, and Reish Lakish was replaced by another person. And every time Rav Yochanan said something, the other person gave 24 reasons why Rav Yochanan was right. "Oh yes, you're right because of this and that and that and that." And Rav Yochanan broke down crying. And he said, how much he misses Reish Lakish. So they asked him, what do you mean? Reish Lakish was attacking you constantly. Everything you said, he was driving you crazy. 24 problems. This rabbi, everything you say, he says you're right. Wonderful. It's a dream. He says, oh no. He says, I don't need somebody to tell me I'm right. If I didn't think I was right, I wouldn't say it. But when Reish Lakish challenged me, and he made me defend my position, and he made me analyze it, and if I was wrong, I withdrew it, and if I was able to clarify it more, I clarified it more. He says, there was something that grew from that. Something new was created. Something better was created. And what Rav Yochanan is saying about the learning of Torah is, of course, equally true in the dynamic of marriage. And that is based on the words, Ezer Kenegdo. Ezer, the helpmate, is in the loving opposition that can exist. Now, we don't look for clones. And the truth of the matter is, let's go back to the Avos. And you see a similar idea. You see, at least in part, you don't necessarily see it throughout the entire pattern. We know, for example, that Avraham's service of God was characterized by loving kindness, benevolence, and compassion. That's called the Midat HaChesed, the attribute of loving kindness. Now Sarah, obviously, was also a kind person. But you see, Sarah was more of the disciplinarian in the family, because Sarah realized, in a way that Avraham could not realize, that unbridled kindness could ultimately destroy a family. And the specific incident I'm referring to is, if you remember, Yishmael was a very destructive influence within the family. He was doing bad things. Again, to use, someone's on drugs, you know, someone's having, you know, sex at home with people, and there's young children in the house. There is a time in which what you need is tough love. There is a time in which one understands that too much kindness can destroy a family, can destroy holiness in the family. Just like if you let your child have unlimited candy, right? He's not going to, right? He'll lose his teeth, etc. So consequently, the loving kindness, which is called chesed, needs to be counterbalanced with the restraints and a certain sense of discipline. And in the Avraham and Sarah relationship, we find that Avraham's chesed needed to be counterbalanced with the sense of restraint that Sarah had. Now the second generation, it's exactly the opposite. In the second generation, Yitzchak represents that force of inner restraint and discipline and control. But that itself could be very offsetting in terms of the effect that it has on a child. And that is why Yitzchak's wife, Rivka, right, her dominant characteristic was the kindness and compassion that she showed. Remember, that's how she was chosen. She was chosen by the fact that she offered water to Eliezer and even to the camels. How did Eliezer know to make that the test? Nobody told Eliezer to make that the test. But the answer is, this is how great Eliezer was. He understood that one whose attribute is Gevurah needs to be counterbalanced by an attribute of Chesed, right? Just like the Chesed needs a Gevurah. Now, what that means is the following. In that type of relationship, the one who has, it's not just one person has the Chesed and one person has the Gevurah. But through that interaction, the Baal Chesed learns a sense of restraint and discipline. And the Baal Gevurah learns a sense of generosity and compassion. And therefore, each person becomes greater than they would have been standing alone. Right, through the creative interaction. Each person grows in that particular aspect. And that's what I meant before when I said the part of them that was dormant and latent can become realized with a certain fullness. And that is the idea of the Ezer Kenegdo, which suggests that the old adage of opposites attract does have a certain validity. Now again, obviously, when I say opposites attract, we're not referring to people that have opposite sets of values. That would be a very, very destructive thing. One person wants to grow in Judaism and the other doesn't care. I would not suggest that as an optimal union, although I am aware of such unions, which sometimes manage to survive, but you know, I wouldn't bet on it. But we're talking about people who have fundamentally the same values and the same goals in life and the same ideologies. But they have different personalities. The quiet, introverted, even on a superficial level, the quiet, introverted, shy person can vicariously learn to relate better to people if they have an outgoing, vivacious, other type of person. And the outgoing, vivacious person who might be sometimes run at the mouth too much can learn a certain sense of dignity and restraint, you know, from the other. So in the ideal situation, we grow by contact with someone who reflects aspects of reality different than the way we commonly behave. Right? So that's all of that is are the words Ezer Kenegdo, a helpmate that is fundamentally opposite. Now the final point I want to make is a well-known thought that's often recited at the Sheva Brachos, the Dvar Torah, and that is, there's a beautiful Gemara in Maseches Yevamos that says that the word for man is Ish, Aleph Yud Shin, and the word for woman is Isha, Aleph Shin Yud. Now, the two words share two carbon letters, Aleph and Shin, which is fire. The man has a Yud, the woman has a Hey. Yud and Hey is God's name. So the Talmud says, when God is in their relationship, men are men and women are women and everything's great. If you take God out of the relationship, all you have is fire. What does that mean? The selfishness and egotism that each will demonstrate will be like a consuming fire that will destroy each other. So that's a beautiful Gemara, but the Maharal takes the Gemara one step further and asks the following question. Why does the man get the letter Yud of God's name? You know, Yud and Hey are God's name. But why does the man get the Yud and the woman get the Hey? Why is it that particular configuration? Yeah.
I actually had some lack of our teaching this, but it's a Yud kind of represents thought, spirit, whereas the Hey is kind of down to earth and take man seen and create a bit.
Yep. Yeah, well, that's very good. That's what the Maharal says. I'm going to flesh that a little bit, but that's exactly correct. The Maharal quotes a Gemara in Tractate Menachos, and the Gemara in Tractate Menachos tells us that God created the world to come with the power of the letter Yud. We don't understand what that means, but our teaching is that the Aleph Beis represents spiritual powers through which God created the universe. The world to come was created with the power of the letter Yud. And this world was created with the power of the letter Hey. And the Maharal explains, this is the Gemara, but the Maharal explains that the idea is the following. What is a Yud? Imagine you have to picture a Yud. A Yud is a little point. It's a tiny little letter. So it has no significant material dimensions. It's just the dots. So a Yud represents pure spirituality that has not yet been embodied in a physical or material representation. Therefore, it is connected to Olam Haba. Hey is a composite of two letters. Imagine how a Hey looks. It's a Dalet, and then on the left, I would call it a Vav, but Maharal says it's a Yud. So it's a Dalet and a Yud. A Dalet and a Yud equals a Hey. Now what's Dalet? Dalet, four, represents the opposite of Yud. If Yud is pure spirit, the number four represents pure materiality. The reason that's so is because matter exists in four dimensions. There's the length and the width and the height and time. Time is a dimension within which matter exists. Or another way of looking at it is simply in terms of directions. We talk about the four directions of matter, north, south, east, west, etc. So Dalet is pure matter. Yud is pure spirit. So what is Hey? Hey is the ability to bring spirit into matter. Now it's very interesting, even numerically though, that Hey as a number is only half of what Yud is. Yud is 10, Hey is 5. That suggests that bringing spirit into matter will dilute the spirit somewhat. But let me explain what I mean by this. But nevertheless, it's still a higher level. And that is to say the following. Now this is what the Maharal says, but in terms of Ish V'Isha, I'm applying the Maharal to this idea. And that is, men generally tend to be corrupted by the material environment. The material environment brings out the worst in us. The work world brings out our competitiveness, our angers, our tensions, our need to dominate, etc. And consequently, we find that just like an asthmatic patient or someone with emphysema needs pure oxygen, men's spiritual renewal tends to take the form of a Yud experience. Yud is the withdrawal from the physical world into a world which is purely spiritual, such as a synagogue, at least within the synagogue, such as a yeshiva, such as a kollel. We need to get away from that world, at least at times, because the world destroys us. Women, and again, these are generalizations because obviously there are men one way and women the other way, we're talking about generalities. Women are blessed with a capacity to be able to sanctify even the material world. A woman can demonstrate that changing a diaper on a baby can be an act of sanctity, an act of godliness, an act of goodness, an act of seeing God in the everyday activities of life. Now, it may very well be that living a life in which the spirit is intermeshed with the physical may not always be as intense a spiritual high, and hence you may be going from a yud to a hey. But ultimately, that is the ultimate purpose of this world. The ultimate purpose of this world, to quote the famous Sefer Tanya, written by the first Lubavitcher Rebbe, the purpose of this world is to make, or the purpose of existence is to make this world a dwelling place for divinity. And therefore we find, for example, that Avraham, his name was first Avram, and God gave him a hay after circumcision, and that refers to the capacity of the Jew to transform and elevate the physical. This is very fundamental. Unlike other religions, for example, that teach that holiness is achieved only by escaping the physical. Holiness is achieved by renunciation, by being celibate, by taking vows of poverty. Although the monastery can own the VCR, but the individual monk is not allowed to own anything. Only by separating and sleeping on a bed of nails or wearing a hair shirt. Judaism believes that we serve God even by indulging in the physical, within the bounds of halacha, that eating, drinking, sleeping, marrying, having children, changing diapers, all of this is holiness. All of this is Kedusha. It's not the Kedusha of the Yud, because it's much more exciting to sit on top of the mountain, or sit where they have the Guinness Book of World Records, some Indian monk who sat on top of a flagpole for 55 consecutive days. I don't know what particular great thoughts came to him during that time, but it may not be as dramatic as that. And indeed, as one is going through physical life, one often feels in a state of, you know, anxiety and not being able to concentrate and not really being able to focus. So it's a hey, it's not a yid. But ultimately, the whole purpose of Ruchnius, spirituality, is that we can make it happen in the here and now, in the everyday, in the mundane. This is the gift of the hey, and this is the particular koach of a woman. And what a woman teaches a man is how to become that way as well. And consequently, the notion of Ezer Kenegdo, the helpmate, is the idea of sanctifying the physical and not rejecting it. And that's a fundamental idea. Because with men, well, actually it goes back to Carol Gilligan's point. With men, it's either or. You know, when we're physical, we're damn physical. And when we're spiritual, we got to have our spirituality pure. But life isn't that way. Life doesn't go from, or it shouldn't go, from the purely ethereal to the purely mundane. There has to be a way to bridge and to connect and intersect those activities. And that is what a woman is, again, more attuned to be able to do. And that is the notion of the Azer Connecto, the Hay, the idea of bringing the Yud into the Dalit. Right, so those are basically some, you know, basic ideas, the notion of becoming a giver, the idea of knowing that part of giving is also being open to take, the idea of creative and loving opposition and making ourselves more than we would otherwise be, and the idea of sanctifying the physical and the mundane. And let me just mention again a few more points. You know, the Song of Songs is a book in the Bible that was written by Shlomo HaMelech. And in the Song of Songs, it is written in the form of a love song between a shepherd and a princess. And it uses a lot of sexual, very, very vivid imagery. And we are told by our Chachamim that it is not an Oriental love song, but it is a metaphor for the powerful love that God has for the Jewish people. And in fact, the Art Scroll, if you ever look at the Art Scroll translation of the Song of Songs, they say It is so dangerous to read this literally, we're not even going to translate it literally. So when a verse says something like, the shepherd embraced the princess, it'll say, when God took us out of Mitzrayim, he did a lot of miracles. And that's what it'll say, kind of robbing. It robs a little of its force, but they say... Because they say it's too prone to being misunderstood. So we will translate it this way. So here's my question. King Solomon is the wisest of all men. He certainly had the insight of the Art Scroll editorial board. So the question is, why didn't he write, when God took us out of Egypt, he did a lot of miracles. Why does he write about the shepherd embracing the princess passionate? And one of the answers is, Shir HaShirim is a parable. Shir HaShirim is not meant to be literal. Shir HaShirim is not about a man loving a woman. It's about God and the Jewish people. But King Solomon is teaching us an important idea. If you want to understand the ultimate meaning of the Song of Songs, if you want to understand divine love, if you want to love God, you have to be able, in your own life, to love another human being as well. You can't love God without first having the capacity to have an intimate love for another human being. And therefore, don't go to the ultimate meaning till you understand the literal meaning. The literal meaning is very important, because the literal meaning is the way that we do come to love God, by our ability to love other human beings. Sometimes people are so... of serfdom. Count Tolstoy. So he was once asked, he was a kind of a moody, irascible gentleman, so he was once asked, if he is so much in favor of the brotherhood of man, why does he treat his own serfs not very nicely? And Tolstoy is said to have remarked, I am a lover of humanity, I just don't like people very much. Meaning, he was in love with the global abstraction of universal rights, but it did not find its expression in the day-to-day interaction. Judaism is in the opposite premise. We're not so interested in some global abstraction. You want to love God? Start by loving the person that you're right next to. Start with the concretes and then proceed to the abstracts. Well, love, love refers to men loving each other too. We don't mean in a sexual way. We talk about the emotional ideas of loving and caring about each other. Avas Yisrael, that's certainly something that Jews strive for. Right? V'ahavta l'recha kamocha, love your friends as you love yourself. Right? So Shir HaShirim teaches us that love of God cannot be rooted in metaphysical speculation, but the love of God must be rooted in the concrete realities of day-to-day interactions. And I'll leave you with one final thought. The Gemara in Brachos has a long section on dream interpretation. If any of you are into dream interpretation, you can learn chapter 9 of Maseches Brachos, and you can see a lot of things about what different dreams mean. And there's a passage in the Talmud that says, if a person dreams of a river, or a kettle, a pot, or a bird, then that is a blessing from God that he will have shalom, peace, in his home. In fact, there's even a book on Jewish marriage written by Rav Aaron Feldman, who was a Rosh Hashiva here, called The River, the Kettle, and the Bird. And it's based on this Gemara. But the Vilna Gaon explains, what is the symbolism of a river, a kettle, and a bird? And the Vilna Gaon says, this represents three different levels of peace that we can have in our lives. Level number one is symbolized by a river. A higher level is the kettle, and the highest level is the bird. What's the river? A river is a connecting link between two points, right? You may have New York and Baltimore. Well, that's the ocean, whatever it is. You can have two cities, huh? Delaware River, whatever it might be. Now, that refers to the basic level of civility in a relationship, where I do my thing, my wife does her thing, we have separate lives, but we communicate with each other. There's civility, there's consideration, there's concern. That's a nice thing to have, the idea of the river. The river connects the two cities, each of which does their own thing, but there's a connection between them. How have I? That, you know, all of our marriages should at least be that. But the Vilna Gaon says, that's not the end point. That's the starting point. But then there's a new level called a kettle. What's a kettle? Consider fire and water. Without a kettle, the fire will put out the water, or the water will, the water will put out the fire, or the fire will cause the water to evaporate. The kettle is a medium that allows each element to accomplish something that they couldn't have done without that medium. In other words, with the kettle, you can make tea, you can make soup. That means, that's the idea of a relationship. Not that I do my thing and she does her thing and we talk to each other at dinner. Although that, again, that is a good level and a basic level. But there's a concept where through our union, we create a whole that is greater than the individual sum of our parts. The fire couldn't do it alone and the water couldn't do it alone. But the kettle is the framework that allows something new to be accomplished. That's a higher level. That's the idea of bringing out within me aspects of my personality that would otherwise not be there. But then there's a highest level, because even in this second level, the water is still water and the fire is still fire. They are separate entities. But there's a certain level, like a bird, the Vilna Gaon says, a bird functions in two opposite environments. A bird is can exist in the sky, and a bird could be on earth. But it's one integrated entity. The highest level of marriage is not, right, again, I think Rabbi Gottlieb uses this phrase, and I'll plagiarize him on this, you've probably heard it. There's the I, and there's the we, but then there's the we, but then there's the single. There's the single entity. They say by Ravari Levin that when he would take his wife to the doctor, she was ill for many years, he would naturally talk and he would say, our foot is hurting. Her foot was not her foot. Her foot was our foot. And he felt the pain. And it is said that after his wife died, a cab driver was taking him home, and he never gave the cab driver an exact address. The cab driver kept on asking him, where do you live? Where's your house? And he said, I don't have a house anymore. I don't have a home. My home was where my wife. If you want to know where I sleep, I'll tell you. This was the sense of the home. And that's what the bird is. And sometimes, you know, I mentioned the joke yesterday. I said it in a negative way, that when you go into a restaurant, how do you know which couples are married and which are not? And the answer is those who aren't talking are married and those who are talking are. Now, you could look at that in a negative way. You could say, well, once you're married, you get bored with each other and there's nothing to talk about. But there's also a positive dimension to that. And that is, sometimes when people grow close, there is no need necessarily to fill the space with words and to fill the space with conversation. Sometimes we make conversation because we're insecure, because we're nervous, because we don't know what the other person is thinking and we're thinking that they're thinking negatively about us. But when there's real unity, just like you don't have to talk to yourself, right? You don't have to talk to yourself. You don't have to talk. One could sit and not talk because one sees the pleasure of just being in each other's company. So sometimes, indeed, it's because people are bored. Sometimes it is a negative sign, but sometimes, you know, you can sometimes see old people who've been married, you know, 70 years or whatever it is. They don't have to say a word to each other. They just know what each other is. And that's the idea of the bird. And God willing, all of us should be zocha. Now, of course, this doesn't mean that, you know, we'll be at the bird level all the time. I mean, that's probably an impossible level to achieve. Although, I remember, this is an amazing thing. When Shlomo Zalman Auerbach died, this to me is one of the most amazing stories I've ever heard, because it's just inconceivable to me. You know, it's customary at a funeral, you always ask the mace, you always say, if I did anything to hurt you, please forgive me. You know, you ask mechila from the mace in front of a minion. So when Shlomo Zalman Auerbach's wife died, and they were married for over 50 years, he was told by the Chevra Kadisha to, you know, it's a formula, everyone does this, you know, go in front of the grave and say, I beg forgiveness for whatever I did to cause you hurt. And he responded, he says, in all of our life together, neither of us ever did anything to the other to cause them any pain. Now, to me, that's a lot more miraculous than the stories about, you know, reviving the dead or whatever they tell about different things. To me, this is just an absolutely phenomenal example of the level that a human being can reach in Shalom Bayis and in the Avodas Hashem. So God willing, all of us should merit at least at some moment in our life to have that bird relationship, or at least the kettle, but l'chol ha'pachas, let's endeavor in our own lives to have the river, because that is the ultimate foundation of which everything else could be predicated. So, Yeshua, we'll see you tomorrow. Okay.